Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Today my guest is Dave Beaky Sims. If you know Dave, he is just a beloved member of the racing community. Such a wealth of warmth and experience and history. Sat down with Dave to talk about, honestly, the hardest day of his life. The saddest day in his long, six-decade-long career. That was the day that his driver, Jim Clark, died. We are celebrating's not the word. We are remembering the great Jim Clark, regarded as not just the greatest driver of his era when he died, the greatest who ever lived. The two-time Formula One world champion, killed in a Formula Two race at Hockenheim on April 7, 1968, 50 years ago. And for Beaky, who was his mechanic at Team Lotus, it's hard at times to listen to his recounting of this, and this isn't the first time that he's shared these stories by any means, but I did want to capture them in person, in audio format, just because I thought that knowing how gracious Dave is and how much he is really transported back 50 years ago to whenever he speaks about this, just wanted this to be something where he and I could share this in a private format and also dive into his origins, where he grew up in the UK, find out that extremely humble means in the Sims household, and learn about his path to Team Lotus and beyond, where he's gone. He's now, and he's been the longtime team manager of the Rese Competizione IMSA and America Le Mans Series program, championship winning, Le Mans winning under Beaky's steerage. But this is looking back to his younger days, and it is somewhat hard to fathom. A guy 25, 26 years old with almost no one at Hockenheim. It was essentially just himself, Graham Hill, Jim Clark, mechanic or two there, and having to deal with the greatest loss imaginable. You take all of the world's most famous race car drivers today, put them together, and I still don't think they add up to what Jim Clark was and what he meant to the world at the time of his death. So I also really appreciate Beaky walking us through this. And getting to know a bit about him leading up to it might help you to further understand how he dealt with this, how this was truly just an earth-shattering moment for him and something that he carries with him every day, like a massive, massive scar. But we also celebrate Jim because he meant so much to so many people, including my father. There was one driver, Jim Clark, spoken of with total reverie, and it's not a coincidence that my father's favorite driver became my first favorite driver. As I learned about him, read his autobiography, I get to speak with a lot of people in our sport, and Dave might not be the most well-known by any stretch of the imagination, but he is a true hero to those of us who do know him. You know, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires on iTunes, on Podbean, and also on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. All right, off we go with learning about Dave Beaky Sims and into what that was like at Hockenheim 50 years ago on April 7th.
So, Mr. Sims, your life and career to me is fascinating, and I think that's due in part because I'm the son of an amateur racer. I grew up at my father's shop, grew up going to the racetrack, wanted to become a race car mechanic, became a race car mechanic, did a lot of things that meant a lot to me. I then look to folks like yourself, you know, where you go, wow, folks like you who blaze trails or did things that helped young cats like me and so many others go, ooh, I want to do that. I dreamt of being a Formula One mechanic. I didn't have the talent to be a Formula 30 mechanic, much less Formula One, but I'd love to know, just starting out, tell me about where you grew up. Tell me about that time and where motor racing became part of your world.
Yeah, born in Salisbury in the West Country, but out in the sticks, you know, during the war, born in 42, so, you know, I'm a war baby. You come from a poor family, mum and dad, you know, cottage out in the sticks, thatch cottage, no water, no electricity, no heating.
Wow.
Toilet at the bottom of the garden, 50 yards, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you know that was normal?
That was normal, yeah, no problem. And then parents moved to Salisbury, which is about 10 miles away in the city, and because they had to move out. And the cottage then, the owner offered my father, if we'll sell it to you for £80.
Oh, so
that was 1945, the end of the war. And no, can't afford that. There's no way, you know. And now I know that cottage, Box 3 Cottage, now it's an admiral who lives in it, a retired admiral. It's £3.2 million
oh,
on the market. Obviously, it's been modernised, of course, and there's
sure,
a beautiful garden that goes down to the bottom of the river. Yeah. So but, you know, and then school in Salisbury, I was not a very good academic at all. I disliked school immensely. And so, and it was a convent, a Catholic convent, which the nuns beat the devil out of me, like you wouldn't believe. And
deserve it or undeserve it?
Well, lots of it was deserved because I was a bit of a rebel. And but, you know, it was unnecessary stuff, so I got fed up with that.
Mm.
So I thought, I got to get out of this. So I threw myself in the river, in the shoreline where the mud was, covered myself in mud, walked home, told my parents, the nuns threw me in. And so that was the end of my school days. So at 14, I just went to a garage and said, you know, I need a job. And they said, okay, how old are you? I said, 15, sign here, son. And that was it, 5-year apprenticeship in a garage in Salisbury.
Had you tinkered with things
no,
beforehand?
Nothing,
or
no,
so you were just...
Did have the foggiest idea. Nothing.
Brilliant.
So, you know, they put me in a lubrication bay. He's a boy, you know, grease monkey.
High respect.
Yeah, you know, all that stuff. But as the years went on through the apprenticeship, you got, you know, and then you got transferred into the workshop and started working on stuff, mainly on Jaguars then.
Mm.
The mechanic I was working under, he was teaching me, he was a Jaguar mechanic. So all the Jags that come in, we'd be working on the Jags and stuff. But anyway, and then there was this rich kid, Roger Sweet, his name was, is in The Salesman.
What a wonderful name.
He was, he had a Cooper Jack 500. Little Cooper's at 500 doing hill climbs. And I thought, well, this is interesting. Don't have to know, make a noise. I like this. And I was then buying books on the Autosport, the original.
Sure.
Looking at racing cars and Grand Prix cars. Oh, this is good.
And today, hill climbing
is,
you know, gone the way of horse racing and many other things. But back then,
yeah,
hill climbs were
was
a big thing.
No, it was a big thing. And I didn't know anything about it. And so I went with that. Roger helped him clean the car and you know, spanner. What I didn't know what I was really doing on this little Cooper Jack.
But
you know, we went hill climbing and had fun, drinking beer and stuff. And from then, he went and bought a Formula 3, which is a Lotus 2022.
Wow!
With a BMC engine in it, a minor 1000 engine, with a Downton-tuned engine, and we had that at Stockbridge Racing with John Fennings.
Mm.
Now he was then Formula 3 top guy.
Yeah.
And John Fennings with the Works Cooper cars. And it was then that we had the garage there and we worked on it serious stuff then and started, you know, doing Brands Hatch, Oaton Park, Mallory Park in Silverstone, which I've got pictures of at Silverstone, him at Woodcut, opposite Locking Through. It's all good stuff, which is going to go in the book. And you know, it was interesting. But, you know, it was learning curve. And John Fennings had a lot to do with, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to, and this is how to set it up, etc. So, oh, really? Oh, okay. And you know, it was a big learning curve.
What's
with John Fennings.
Who's being set up? Am I being set
yeah,
up?
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, towings, cambers, and making the thing square, and, which we didn't bother to start with. Oh, this is all right, just send it out. But, you know, we learned quite a lot of stuff with John. And that was then that Colin Chapman wanted John Fennings in his F2 car, first race, next to Jimmy.
Jeez.
On his way to pole, John, in his 3.8 Jag, never even got to Dover, hit a truck head-on, and that was the end of his racing career.
Good Lord.
Never got there. And then he was seriously ill, and he's still alive to this day, John. And but, no, that was it. That was the end of that. From then on, as the years progressed, I thought, an advert in Autosport. Race mechanics needed. Team Lotus. Whoa, what? I'll have a go at this. So
what year would that have been?
That would have been end of 65.
So you're in your early 20s. Your parents, you did a good sales job on the nuns and the mud and the river.
Mm-hmm.
Went down this apprentice path. You're traveling throughout the UK, going to, you know, what anyone would regard as classic tracks.
With no money.
It sounds nonetheless like you've gone from nothing, growing up in the sticks, to scholastic life, which was not particularly pleasant, especially with the nuns,
mm-hmm.
to this bit of an adventure. Was there a sense of, in terms of how far your life had come in a short amount of time, that this might be something I want to do seriously for a long time?
Yeah, it really registered to me, and I started following race results, formula, who is who and who does what. And that's why I put the application in. I told her I was married and young married. I was 23 and married. And I'm still am, by the way, believe it or not. A lot of people don't believe it. So I sent it off, and I got a letter back, and said, no, I'm sorry that, you know, the vacancy's been taken and that blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, well, never mind. Please keep in touch. A week later, another letter come back. Sorry, we sent you the wrong letter. Yes, you've been accepted. Please come to Chesson on such and such a day for an interview with Mr. Bob Dance.
Wow.
And I'm going, oh, wow. So I took the Henleys. Henleys was the garage then, the late 35 van. So I took it, went to London in it.
Oh, wow.
To Chesson. By then, there was no ring road, no motorway. Yeah, it was just no problem. A-through it all the way, no big traffic. So I went to saw Bob Dance and in Chesson in this Team Lotus. And immediately I saw a green and yellow truck and unloading a Formula One car. And I, oh, this is it.
Your eyes.
This is it. Yeah. And it was an old Bedford. And this is a life. Oh, this is it. This has got to work. So it took me in, and it was only a small garage. And there was an Indy car up on stands, Formula Ones, Lotus Cortinas. And I'm going, and it was a really small garage at Chesson. And I thought, oh. And yeah, he said, yeah, you got the job. When can you start? I said, next week. I said, where am I going to live? So they got me a bed and breakfast in Tottenham, North London. Bed and breakfast, all paid for. So this is us, wave goodbye to the missus, and that was it. Never got home for weekends after weekends. Chapman didn't too worry about people having days off or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
No way. Hence the evil genius was his nickname from the boys, the old man. And that was it. They put me on Cortinas with Jimmy and Peter Arundel, were the drivers of the British Saloon Car Championship then. And I was on both cars. They put me from the, and they kept bringing up these drawings, blueprints, going, well, we need this made, Dave. And I'm going, I've never seen one of these things before. What am I supposed to do here? Well, we've got to start making this bracket for this. And I'm going, I need a bit of help here. So they took me in hand. Bob Sparshot was there then.
Wow.
He was BS Fabrications.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he helped me. Sid Carr, who is now in California doing race prep on historics. So they helped me with this fabrication, and I've got the knack of it. Learning to weld, it's really good. And
your second apprenticeship.
Yeah, and then we moved up to Norwich, to Hethel. Big new shop, big factory, fantastic. And kept on Cortinas. And then it came out, they said, well, we're going to move you to Formula 2. And okay. So me and a guy called Mike Gregory was on Graham's car and I was on Jimmy's car. And because, you know, by then we knew the drivers and the know-how and the single. And you know, we race prep and we went test at Snetterton to check the cars out and know everything okay. And in the first race was Barcelona. Monjuke Park.
Good Lord.
Right through the park.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was me and Mike Gregory, Carnoustie was his nickname because of the golf.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a golfer, Carnoustie, because the golf course in Scotland. And it was him and me. That was it. Loaded the truck, race prepped. No chief mechanic, nothing.
Just
the two of us, drove all the way to Barcelona. You didn't think nothing of it then, you know?
Well, did you have an appreciation for what you were in the midst of at in your formative days at Lotus? And I ask that because I think to anyone, you know, somewhat younger fans looking back, they must assume that this was just the Roman Empire and luxury and glory and everything. Obviously, great reputation, amazing results. But the reality is, to your point, this a lot of it was smoke and mirrors, folks.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It was hard. It was hard. It was even when you were at Hethel race prep, and you had to make the spares, you had to build the car, you had to do a lot and hours. I mean, you work hours after hours after hours. And food wise, especially when you're on the road, got to Dover, you know, we try and grab some sandwiches somewhere, and then or stop at a grocery shop, buy bread and cheese. So I would be driving, Carnoustie would be making bread and cheese sandwiches, and vice versa. When he's driving, and we got then, you know, got the Barcelona unloaded. Then we had Dougie Bridge come over. He flew over to help us. He's like just a chief, and you know, we didn't have a horde of engineers or anything, so you had your clipboard and your pen, and your lap chart, and a stopwatch, and you know, driver would come in and say, do the shock absorbers, soften them up the front, 3 clicks, please. Or make the roll bar worse. Stuff. Just that was all you could do.
Yeah.
Or lower the car. Or as you know, there was no wings on the car, no aerodynamics. But Jimmy, being Jimmy, Graham was in the other car. And Barcelona, we qualified on the second row behind Ix. And on the grid, the Ferrari decided to fit new pads on X's F2.
Yeah.
In the first corner, no brakes, Jimmy went in the back of him, and that was it. Done, race over. Graham blew his engine, same race. So we were then, two of us, we had a crash car and a blown engine. Off we go to Hockenheim that night, load up, and drive all the way to Germany, Hockenheim. That's when it was freezing cold that weekend.
Yeah.
And it was, we got there, we had to repair the cars, we worked all night underneath the hotel. The hotel looks off, still there in Hockenheim, and there's pictures on the wall there still. And then the owner, his son, operates it now. And we worked underneath the garage, and we helped each other, we changed the engine. He helped me do the repairs on Jimmy's car. But it was freezing cold, frost in the morning. And the metering units were freezing up.
Yeah,
because you had a brass bearing.
Fuel metering, yeah. Fuel meter.
Against a metal bearing.
Mm.
And the cold would freeze, and it would throw the mechanical fuel pump belt break. And it misfires, so it get boiling water. That's how we cured it in the end. That knowing how to do it. We covered it with all sorts of stuff to keep it off. But in the race, just the two of us again.
What was this dynamic like for you with a Graham, with a Jimmy? We're used to, if we're looking at Formula One today or NASCAR, G5 Lear private jet comes in, you know, shortly before practice, first practice. They're on that plane within an hour of the checkered flag. Obviously interact with the crew, but they're almost in a different world. What was it like? Very simple time of you, very few people. Is the culture and dynamic between you and the drivers one of class separation, or is this just mates?
No, it was not class separation, especially Graham was a social gentleman anyway, but he realized what the work involved for the mechanics. He was very generous like that. He realized, although he did make a lot of work. Jimmy was completely understood the problems, and he understood the problems of one mechanic per car, you know, when there was a problem. And he understood that. And Jimmy, it was like your friends. You were friends. You weren't hoity-toity. You know, Jimmy and Graham wouldn't go off and say, see ya. They'd make sure that everything is done properly and check on us, you know, to say, hey, did you do this? Did you do that? Great. Well done, lads. You know, I'll see you in the morning.
Mm.
And then they wouldn't just go off and do that sort of stuff. But it was different. Oh my God, it was different altogether. And, you know, and when he went missing, we didn't know. Did he break down, you know? And a course car came round and said, Jim Clark, mechanic. Yeah, jet in here, please. I said, well, what's the problem? Car crash. I said, oh. And we got there, you know, and I saw an ambulance. And then I'm going, being young, you know, well, is he okay? Can't say. Then I saw the car. I thought, oh, nothing left of it. No gearbox and engine. Well, where is that? Where's the engine and gearbox? Oh, through the woods. So it sighed through the woods after he hit the tree, obviously. And then the shock took in. I said, can I see him? He said, no.
And that's something, Dave, I mean, you've been asked about this a million times. You've spoken so generously and graciously about it. The world lost the greatest race car driver.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow, you know, we're sitting here, and I don't say anniversary as if it's something that it's celebrated, but I think of you, and I apologize for briefly speaking about myself here, but when I was 19, working my very first day, working for a professional race car team as a mechanic, I was in charge of running the Sports 2000. It was a small little prototype for a guy named Tom Blackaller, who was a skipper of the America's Cup.
Okay.
In the 80s, you know, the America's Cup was very popular here. He was very well known. He had lied to the doctors to get his racing license. And it was my first morning on the job. This is the team based out of Sears Point that Jimmy Vassar had come out of and was somewhat well known. And here I am, my first morning on the job running Tom Blackaller, very famous yeah. sporting person. 15 minutes into opening session, car doesn't come around. And somewhat similar situation, except for they brought the car back without him, and there was no explanation. Come to find out that he had pulled off coming out of the carousel, had a massive coronary, and died instantly. So at least for my first day, having my driver, who I didn't pretend, I mean, I just met him that morning, but he died.
Yeah.
Media, TV cameras coming in, they obviously were more interested in talking to the team owner than me, but I was completely ill-prepared to deal with a driver dying.
Absolutely.
When I was 19. You were a little bit older than me, but I think of you and have always thought of you in this instance of Jim Clark, the world's greatest driver, dying and you having to come to that scene and deal with it. There wasn't a Colin Chapman to handle everything for you and shield you and protect you. What was it like for you stepping in and seeing this catastrophic scene on a personal level of processing? I don't know how you did that.
It was something that it will never be forgotten in my head, because I didn't believe what I was seeing. And you heard these stories about, oh, I don't believe what I saw. Well, I didn't. I thought, this is a bad dream. I can't believe this is right. Where was he? I said, where was Jimmy? And I looked at the car, and they said,
you knew the answer.
I said, I can't believe this. And what do I do? I can't believe. I was in shock. I didn't know what shock was, but I suddenly felt pale and a bit sick, nauseous actually, and I don't know, what do I do? So I said to the race was still going on, Graham was still going round, so I asked the marshal who took me in the pace car, can you call the pits and tell Michael Gregory, the mechanic, tell Graham to come in, please, in. and they shortened the race, and then I was still there, and Graham came out, and he says, right, okay, Beaky, what we got to do, get the truck here, get it loaded, and we got another team, a couple of mechanics to help load all the wreckage in, and Graham Hill was a god, organization, because I know what do I do?
Your kids.
I don't know what, you know, and Graham said, okay, come and sit with me for 5 minutes, calm down. He said, this is what we're going to do, okay? This is what we're going to, and I just went under Graham's directions, and we got all the stuff back into the truck and back to the paddock, and he said, don't open the truck to anybody, because it was just bits and pieces and stuff, and he had to go duo and identify Jimmy. Someone had to identify someone who has died, and then the shotgun comes in, and me and Carnoustie, we went back to the hotel with the truck, and then with the police, and the police car said, you can't leave the police, you can't leave Germany. And
Chapman, times are very different then in how the race was dealt with.
Yes, it's murder, manslaughter. So basically Chapman arrived 1 a.m, we were still up, and he said, what the hell have you done? I said,
Jesus.
I don't know, it's a crash, you know. Well, he says, right, okay. Graham was there, and Graham told him to calm down, you know, let's get this sorted. And Chapman said, well, I want the truck out of here now. I said, we can't, the police car's in front of it. He said, I don't care, we've got to get it out of Germany. So half an hour later, the little Volkswagen disappeared, police car disappeared. So me and Carnoustie, Chapman said, well, get going. Well, okay. So we got going. We said, well, keep off the autobahns and go west, go to coast, make for Zeebrugge, Belgium, wherever.
Get out of here.
Get to coast. And Zeebrugge was where the return ticket was. To Harwich. Zeebrugge, Harwich. It was a 7-8 hour crossing. So we went through Germany, the villages, and driving with a map. Obviously, you had no telephones in those days.
GPS wasn't working then.
No. And we got there and we went up over to Spa. Mm-hmm. We come to some, you know, Spa Frankenshore was a big map. So we went, took another little hill up, across, and went climbing. We come to a red and white barrier. Customs, nobody there, unmanned customs. Wow. Which in those days there was up in the hills. So we opened it up and drove through, then in no man's land. Then we got to the Belgium. So we get non-stop all the way. We found, you know, on the map, Zeebrugge. Got to Zeebrugge, and the guy said, tickets. Jim Clark. Yeah, I want to look. Take a photo. I said, no, you can't. He said, okay, no photograph, no boat, no ship. You have 30 minutes.
Wow.
If you shut the gate of the boat, it's loading.
Jesus. That's so, a little morose.
Yeah. But, so I said to Noosey, we've got to do it. Open the door. I said, that's it. It's just a mess. Nothing. There's canvas covered over the car anyway. He took some canvas. He said, go. So we got on the boat. We got there, and the English police was waiting for us at Harwich. So I said, well, the police said, no, we're just going to escort you there. He said, because there's a lot of press and people going on. And it had to stay outside of Hethel for 48 hours.
Really?
Some law. But then we got it back in, unloaded it all. Chapman sent the engine to Cosworth, gearbox to Hewlin, and all the broken bits and pieces, whatever was left, went to Farnborough Aircraft Establishment Crash Control. and they found nothing cracked, or all the bolts were still in the wishbones and everything was tight. Engine was good, it didn't seize. Gearbox was nothing seized.
Doing a bit of a forensic.
So the tyres went to Firestone. And that's where the right rear deflation, they said, was the cause of the accident. And 3 days later, I went to work, and of course everybody was saying, you know, I'm always a bad guy. The certain newspapers, British newspapers, said, "Oh, mechanic left bolts loose," you know, and this, and people just thought, you know, it was a place, and then
there must be someone to blame.
It was bad media. But then they got over that, and then I went in, and Chapman called me in. I said, "Well, what do I do now?" He said, "What do you mean? What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, what do I do? You know, I was Jimmy's mechanic on the car, and he's dead. What do I do?" He said, "What do you do?" He said, "You're going to Harama tomorrow, you and so and so, towing Graham's new chassis down to the Grand Prix." He said, "You know, come on." He said, "You know, get your act together." Oh, really? Oh, okay. So the fabrication shop was just fitting a new nose, etc., etc., and the shop mechanics were finishing it off, and Formula One people, and I towed it down with another guy to Madrid. Next day, I had to with a van in a trailer, and it was Graham's spare car for the race.
How were you received or treated once you were back, you know, on the shop floor?
Brilliantly.
Hmm.
That was a big plus. All the mechanics who were Jimmy's mechanics long before I was, in Formula One, Indy cars, saloon cars, sports cars, guys, you know, there was Bob Sparshot, Sid Carr, Dougie Bridge, Willie Cow, you know, and all the Kiwis and the Aussies. I can name them, go on and on and on. They were tremendous.
Lifted you up.
Oh. That would have been the end of my career if it had gone the other way.
Mm.
Because to this day, I can't really explain how I felt, and tomorrow is a sad day.
There's almost I don't know if it's a survival thing or the best way to describe it, but had you been assigned to the shop, all right, just have you tink around here for the next month or so, I imagine that would have made things a lot worse. There's a part of me that thinks saying back on the road could have been a good thing to keep your mind focused.
I think if I'd have been sideloaded and not traveling, then I think I would have probably gone back to the garage as a mechanic.
Hmm.
But I'd say that the guys were super, the fab shop, you know, they, because some of the guys there had lost people before, and Ian Stacey and you know, and other people, and they were really, really helpful to the point of, you know, okay, let's get on with it, and you're going tomorrow, you know, get home, have a bath, get changed, and be ready to go early in the morning. So-and-so's got your Dover tickets. And then, you know, this is where you're going to Harama. You've never been there. You've got to do this, do that. And, you know, well, all of a sudden, responsibility was back on, and you were doing it. And your mind had to focus on that. And that's how, really, that really helped me. The guys were unbelievable. There was a Kiwi called Alan McCaw.
Yeah, yeah.
Alan McCaw. Anyway, his nickname was Murray Dog. And he was a great help, you know.
Last question on this topic. It's a lot of weight. a lot of emotional weight on one shoulder. You've got the press, you've got other people looking to pin blame. You get right back on the road. Is there a point in time during this era, late 60s, even early 70s, where you had a chance to take a breath and reconcile this? You know, you get into a car crash, wake up beaten up, bloody, your body, your bones might heal, but there's still that part of like, whew, I just went through something that I need to purge that at some point. You've been able to do that?
I don't think I ever have, and I don't think I ever will. I can go to bed sometimes, you know, after a hard day at the track or anywhere these days. And like tomorrow will be a bad day for me, in remembrance. I can never get out of my head. I don't think I ever will.
And that was a look inside Dave Beaky Sims' life and his world, dating back to German Forest, April 7, 1968, and a little bit of his thoughts in the aftermath of that. Again, there's a reason why we love him so much. There's also a reason why we continue to wait as patiently as possible for his autobiography to come out, which is going to contain a lot of other great stuff with other Formula One teams, sports cars, IndyCar, you name it. He has led a full and amazing life for sure, and definitely someone who has been an inspiration for me for many years, as I mentioned to him. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Thank you for listening.